hope, optimism. They are similar words in their meaning to some, but not to me. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, optimism is hopefulness and confidence about the future or the successful outcome of something, a tendency to take a favorable or hopeful view. Hope is the expectation of something desired, desire combined with expectation. I don't know. As I'm using them, because I want to pull them further apart than those definitions do, optimism is going to be fact-based, based on science, based on data. And as I'm using it, hope is a more spiritual quality. Both are important, and today we are talking mostly about optimism. So this month, our theme has been journey. And journey, as we've seen all month, can happen on many levels and planes. We've gone for the journey into your future with our stewardship theme of faith in our future. We chose to bless the world by traveling the journey from charity to advocacy to relational understanding of social justice needs and relational activities to promote social justice. You journeyed with Mary Oliver and her poetry through nature and questioning. And now we are on the journey to optimism. I've got to say, optimism is a funny topic for the moment. Many of us are wrenchingly torn by the things going on in our world. Whether your heart is broken because of the latest signs of global climate change, bomb cyclones in the Midwest or in Madagascar, or your reaction to current politics in Washington, D.C., or the ongoing separation of parents and children in our so-called immigration system, there is much that might lead you to feel pessimistic for our national or even global future. So that's one reason that optimism is kind of an odd topic. The second is that my supervisor in my internship, which I completed before coming here, Reverend Nancy McDonald Ladd, just published a book on some of these subjects. She is a respected thinker, a wise woman, a brilliant and heartfelt Unitarian Universalist minister. Her congregation, River Road, is just up the way. And she wrote her recent book while she was my supervisor, literally closing her door for a few hours a week to focus on her writing. She spoke with me about her thinking and conclusions often when we met one-on-one for those terrific supervisory sessions. So, you know what's really funny about the title of this sermon, Facts and Optimism, is that her book's title is After the Good News, Progressive Faith Beyond Optimism. She believes that liberal religion, our religion, is not characterized by endless human advancement, but by lurching movement, crisis management, and pain. She calls religious progressives, that is to say most of us here, to greater truth-telling rather than blind optimism. She writes about reclaiming rituals of atonement and lament and becoming more vulnerable and accountable in our relationships. Okay, so she's got one take on optimism and faith and in a faith context, and I'm talking about another here in this sermon. As I said briefly already, to me, hope is a theological concept. For instance, after World War II, when Germany was liberated, this inscription was found on the wall of a cellar where many Jews lived secretly underground for the entire duration of the war. They hid, knowing that their capture by Nazis would lead to their death. They knew that any sound, any crack of light, maybe even a smell might reveal their presence and lead to their being taken to the gas chambers. What was found on that wall was this statement of faith hope. I believe in the sun, even when it is not shining. I believe in love, even when feeling it not. I believe in God, even when he is silent. Those Jewish men had faith that faith manifested itself as intense belief and hope in the future. Hope that the sun would shine on them. Hope that they would feel love again, and that they would hear the voice and feel the presence of God in their lives. Or this is another blessing for hope by Methodist minister Reverend Jan Richardson. This restless hope is what drives me beyond the weariness, beyond the discomfort, beyond every thought that what I carry with me will never come to birth. This restless hope beyond all reason flutters beneath my heart and grows within my soul. It is beyond me, and it is of me, and it is delivering me home. Yeah, that's hope. And I hope that you all experience hope, at least some, for some part of each worship time on Sundays. Maybe not for the whole service, but at some moment you experience a glimmer, or what I've loved to call a sparklet, of something deep inside that propels you into the next day, through the next pain, and moving forward through all of this worldly heartache. But for me, optimism is something else. Something perhaps Reverend Nancy would agree with. I haven't spoken with her about it. I'm talking about the facts that we can miss completely, the ways the world is changing for the better. Not deluded finger crossing, wishing, but real scientific world facts. It's getting better, folks, facts. Not in every way, but let me tell you a few. My journey down this road started with the book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined by Steven Pinker. I'm a former Quaker, and as you know, I'm still a pacifist at heart. I hate wars and violence of any kind. I read this book expecting to experience feel-good pablum. I did not think it was going to be data-driven, and I was absolutely amazed to find his truly compelling argument that violence has been diminishing for millennia, and that we may be living at the most peaceful time in our species' existence. He contends that for most of history, war, slavery, infanticide, child abuse, assassinations, pogroms, gruesome punishments, deadly quarrels, and genocide were ordinary features of life. But today, Pinker shows with a ton of documentation, he has a footnote section you wouldn't believe, that all of these forms of violence have been dwindling and are widely condoned. He quotes Franklin Pierce Adams as saying, "Nothing is more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory." We can go into Pinker's exploration of the essence of human nature, how he understands our intrinsic motives, the inner demons that incline us toward violence, and the better angels that steer us away, and how changing circumstances have allowed our better angels to prevail. But the bottom line that he tells us is that actually we are living in a safer, less violent world than our parents, grandparents, or certainly our distant ancestors. He convinced me, in this way, the world is getting better. It made me a bit more optimistic, using the definition of optimism that I gave before. Why didn't I know that? Why did I have to read all 844 pages of this book to believe him? Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman has an answer with his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Kahneman helps develop the principle of behavioral economics, which points out that we are not always logical or rational in our lives or our economic lives. Kahneman promotes the notion that human behavior at any given moment is an interplay between two forms or systems of thinking, he calls them. So-called system one thinking is fast, intuitive, completely unintellectual. We do things that we do automatically or have absorbed so that we do them almost without thinking fall into this group. For example, walking, talking, knowing the answer to 2 + 2, driving a car, and interestingly, reacting emotionally. These are all system one activities. System two, however, is the brain's slower, more deliberative, and analytic mode. It doesn't do 2 + 2. That will be diverted off to system one. But it can do multiplication, fractions, and for some people, higher math. It gets involved in difficult life decisions, in self-control, and sometimes checking and correcting intuition. The main thing about System 1, Daniel Kahneman says, is that it can't be turned off. System 1 is just always going in the background. The main thing about System 2, even though we might imagine it to be what we would like to think of as our real mind, is that it's lazy. It's very capable of just agreeing or believing or rationalizing what our fast thinking is telling us to do and say. Since it's easier to think with our System 1 minds than our System 2 minds, we can easily jump to conclusions that are wrong. Again, System 2 is lazy. It takes work to get it to go. It will defer to System 1 and jump to an answer that is easy and perhaps not so thoughtful. So we are predisposed to generalizations, believing what the latest headlines told us as if they were a trend, and generally jumping to easy conclusions. All of that wisdom from Kahneman sets the stage for my having believed that our world was more violent than ever before. It prevented me from looking at facts I knew, such as death counts from different wars or the decrease in actual executions through the death penalty. Those are facts I knew. And now on to the third book of today, and all of those are listed in your order of service if you want to see which ones I'm talking about. That's called Factfulness, 10 Reasons We Are Wrong About the World by Hans Rosling. Factfulness is written by a Swedish professor who has worked around the world in many developing countries. His specialty is global health, so he isn't a geographic area expert like Africa, Asia, whatever, but rather someone that countries call in when there is a health crisis. He was called in to work on Ebola, and he literally discovered the cause of several diseases that had not previously been understood at all. Indeed, you could say that he was seeing countries in the global south at their most troubled, right? He's called in when there's a crisis. Now, I had a master's in international development back in the day, before my last career, and certainly before this one. I say, not because it was taken away, but because this book taught me so much about today's global south. I don't feel that I can continue to claim that former credential. Rosling starts his book by asking 13 questions about the world today. There are multiple choice questions, and I thought I'd read the sample from Kindle, ace that test, do great, and pat myself on the back, and never have to buy the actual book. Was I wrong? Here is one question from that test. Worldwide, in the last 20 years, the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has A, almost doubled, B, remained more or less the same, C, halved. I figured things were about the same today as they were a long time ago when I lived in India doing research on stoves and poverty and health for my PhD. Back then, there was more wealth in some places, but others had not progressed, and poverty was a visible and painful blight. So I went with B, remained more or less the same. But my heart was kind of in answer A, almost doubled. Maybe the number of extremely poor people had doubled. I figured if I got it wrong, it was because I was being optimistic. So went the other questions. I answered all 13 of them, and then I went back to see my scores, and I got, five. 5 out of 13, right. And you know which way my answers were wrong every time? Was it towards optimism or was it towards pessimism? Every time it was towards pessimism. I got the questions on global climate change right and some about endangered animals. But the education for girls, number of children surviving, vaccination rates, life expectancy in the world today, population growth globally, wrong, wrong, wrong. I was so wrong. The real answer to the question about change in extreme poverty was that it has almost halved. Over the past 20 years, the proportion of the global population living in extreme poverty has almost halved. This is absolutely revolutionary. Probably the most important change that has happened in the world in my lifetime. It is also a pretty basic fact to know about life on Earth. But people do not know it. I did not know it. On average, only 7%, less than 1 in 10, of people who answer this question globally get it right. That is considerably worse than if everyone was just guessing on their answers. I thought I knew the answer, and I was wrong on that question, and so were 93% of Americans who answered this survey. All of which, of course, led me to buy the book and read it pretty thoroughly, and I found out that I wasn't alone in doing terribly on the test. About 80% of Americans got scores like mine, that is to say, kind of four or five out of the 13. And here is a punchline. The worst scores were often from highly educated folk like me. In fact, he makes the point repeatedly that only actively wrong knowledge can make a score so badly. Actively wrong knowledge, ouch. So back to optimism. To cut to his punchline, 85% of humans currently have the characteristics that back in my day when I was doing my master's in international development, when I was living in India and studying people in the, at that time called developing world, 85% of humans currently have the characteristics that back then were considered almost middle class. The remaining 15% of the world population are mostly poor, but only 15%. Only 13 countries, representing 6% of the world population, are still developing the way I thought of it back when I got my master's in international economic development. But while the world had changed, worldviews have not, at least in my head, and maybe in yours. Globally, people now generally have small families. Child deaths are relatively rare in the vast majority of countries, including China and India. I lived in India. Yeah, 35 years ago. I did not see this coming. In Rebecca Solnit's wise words, if you take the long view, you will see how startlingly, how unexpectedly, but regularly things change. Things change, and sometimes for the better, and not always. And yes, we have to work for betterment in the causes that matter to us where positive change isn't happening at all. Or fast enough. But you know, the monarch population in Mexico this year was up by 144%. Another good fact. Blessed be. Ashe and amen.